of proof in a claim. You know, did it rise to the level of a constructive discharge? Some do, some don't. So it's not on all cases. Again, it's going to be a fact-specific, how bad was it?
Okay, I guess that's my question is that if you were to look up in some Oregon Civil Rights handbook on what the rule of constructive discharge is, it would say at the first line, constructive discharge occurs when a reasonable person in the employee's position would consider working conditions so unacceptable as to force a resignation. Okay, it would say that. And then it'd say, subject to these six exceptions or six modifications or whatever. I don't know if they're there or not. I haven't looked it up. But what I'm saying is that we're going from case law to statutory law, and if we're going to be careful about what we're doing, and what I hear you saying is all we want to do is put into statute what's already in the case law.
Correct.
Then I'm just asking you what else besides, we already touched on one thing, that the conditions have to be created by the employer as opposed to some schmuck walking off the street. That's one of maybe a list of five or six or ten or three, I don't know. What else is there?
I guess I'm having a little trouble. There's not a laundry list of what would be yes or no. It's fact-specific reasonable person test.
Representative Johnson, I think what I maybe am failing to convey in some way is that those sort of fact-specific things are found during the investigative process. And certainly what we could do is perhaps by rule delineate some of your concerns when this legislation is through. We don't have a problem in working with the committee and laying some of those things out. If that would increase your comfort zone.
And reviewing a number of the cases and saying which things rose the level of intolerability.
Yeah, these seem to be the
did not.
You're inviting me to make my don't say trust me argument that I've made several times already this session. With all due respect, we are not. I am not in the business this year of passing laws with a blank check. You're filled in however you like, Mr. or Mrs. Agency Director. There's a lot of dissatisfaction out there among Oregonians because we've past legislators and legislatures have done that and been surprised when the rules got written in a different way than was intended. Anyway, what I just want to get to is we've already touched on one, I assume that if we added a phrase that required the working conditions be created or controlled or allowed or whatever by the employer, that wouldn't bother you. That would just flesh out the existing rule.
Right? That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one thing. I think I'd like, I guess we're going into work session today anyway, aren't we? Before this thing is rescheduled for a work session, could you provide me with whatever
types of things would be
sure,
covered?
Sure, we'd be happy to.
We could easily do that. The types of things that are in case law already.
Right. Again, I'm not trying to change the case law. I just want to make sure that what we put in the statute doesn't somehow erase the existing case law and leave it up to some court or judge to reinterpret what you're already satisfied with and what apparently is working fine.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, no, we don't have a problem with that. Sue and I can put our heads together. What my concern is that in our haste to be responsive that we don't omit something or close a door that we didn't mean to do so.
Maybe, I don't know if this is ever done, but maybe even a clause that says, case law that's interpreted the phrase constructive discharge to be referred to.
Referring to the Senate staff measure analysis, they set out in the background a cite or a test from the Bratcher versus Skychef's case that says there are three elements to the tort. The employer deliberately created or deliberately maintained. This was with the intention of forcing the employee to leave, and the employee, in fact, left because of those conditions. Three elements. As I understand, I guess what we've been talking about this morning is you have no problem with the first requirement that the employer deliberately create or deliberately maintain a condition, or the result that the employee left because of that condition.
Right. It's number 2.
It's number two that you really object to, and I think I understand that. So you would, I assume, have no objection if we were to insert here in, I guess it's where line 7 of the bill, we're talking about the working conditions, which the employer deliberately created or deliberately maintained. Because that tracks exactly with what the Supreme Court language is. And It doesn't take a rocket scientist or a Supreme Court judge to figure out that that's what we're getting at if we insert that in this bill.
Right. Representative Durfler, Representative Edmondson, that would be perfectly satisfactory.
Okay.
You're correct. It's number two that is the stickler for
it's
us.
The intent of the employer.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah, we got that one solved.
I would like to ask a question. Apparently, what I understand is happening is that you felt there was a case law or there was an established rule of how things were solved, and all of a sudden we had a court case which didn't agree with what you thought was correct.
And doesn't agree with what
right.
the EEOC thinks.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
why would
that's correct.
Could you perhaps tell me why the court didn't agree with the law that you thought was there?
Representative Durfler, what the Supreme Court dealt with, they were dealing with the intentional tort of wrongful discharge. Wrongful discharge. And then for some reason that we can't determine, and this is one thing that the Department of Justice and Boley agree on this time, we have no idea why in those two cases the Court of Appeals applied an intentional tort standard to a statutory civil rights case. Neither party brought it up. Neither party asked for it. It just came out of the blue with absolutely no explanation. We really don't know why. Department of Justice couldn't help us on this issue at all. It just happened, but what we're concerned and why we're here today is with the effect of that second point that Representative Edmondson just delineated, trying to determine what the intent of the employer is and the effect that would have on statutory civil rights law. And at your direction, we would be happy to work with committee counsel and to come up with some other language if that would...
Okay, any other questions, ladies? Thank you very much for your testimony. We have Carl Fredericks. Do you want to bring Kathy with you,
yes.
Carl? Okay, thank you.
My old friend. We've been on a dozen panels at the radio
one?
Talk
Who's
show.
That? Carl?
Yeah.
Kathy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the
Welcome
House
to
Labor
both
Committee.
Of you to the Labor Committee.
Kathy and I were just reminiscing the last time we appeared together. We were arguing or opposing the bill that set up 2091, if I recall, on comparable worth before any of you were here.
How'd you do on that?
We were going down memory lane.
You didn't do too well on that.
My name is Carl Frederick. I'm Vice President and Director of Legislation for Associated Oregon Industries, and I'd like to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 38. We understand the thrust of the Bureau of Labor and Industry's rationale for introducing the proposal. The agency apparently is concerned that the case of Bratcher versus Skychefs would overrule what they consider to be a long-established theory of constructive discharge in statutory civil rights cases. And quite frankly, we feel that the standard articulated by the Bratcher case is not unreasonable. The decision specifically states that previous witness indicated, quote, in sum, to establish a constructive discharge stemming from unacceptable working conditions, a plaintiff must prove, one, that the employer deliberately created or deliberately maintained the working conditions, two, with the intention of forcing the employee to leave the employment, and then three, that the employee left the employment because of the working conditions, end of quote. Again, we consider that standard outlined in the Bratcher case to be a reasonable one. We don't believe that it is sufficient for the employee to merely show that he or she believed the working conditions were intolerable. So we would respectfully urge you to table Senate Bill 38. Kathy Peck has some comments. Her background is in labor law, and I will have some copies of the Bratcher decision. I don't know if that was handed out to the...
Before
which I
ask,
give to you.
Is it your, Mr. Frederick, is it your... testimony that this is a this test that's set up here is that that the employee need only prove the employee believed these conditions were
that's why I read that a reasonable person would
but a reasonable person is not and that's an objective standard not a subjective word that all that it existed in all the world the only person who believed this was one person and that was the employee maybe they're deluded and that a reasonable person would not have considered that it seems to me that This bill, I would agree with you that if solely you know is in the eye of the beholder, that's a virtually impossible test to ever defend against. But if it's a reasonable person, well, that's something that's a little different.
They believe that a reasonable person would consider the working conditions unacceptable. Say it could. I would.
So is that do you disagree with the reasonable person test?
I disagree with your interpretation of the reasonable person test.
Well, okay, perhaps Kathy can respond to that.
Kathy?
Okay. First of all, let me tell you, I'm a partner in the management labor law firm of Williams, Graffitz, Peck, and Atwood, and I've been a management labor law attorney for about 13 years now.
It's been a while since you've been here, but you have to tell us who you are.
Oh, right. That's right. It may change. There are a couple points I'd like to make just in opening, and then I'd like to allow you an opportunity to ask me some questions. First of all, I'd like to respond to the notion that what we're talking...
What the chairman was getting at is you also need to state your...
Oh, I'm sorry. Kathy A. Peck, P-E-C-K.
Thank you.
Kathy with a K.
What I'd like to respond to first is just this notion that what's being asked is simply a correction of a very long, well-established precedent and a correction of something that needs to be done because of a Supreme of a Court of Appeals decision. I don't see it that way. It's true that the EEOC has a standard that is very close to what is incorporated in this bill. But right now, the Fourth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit require some type of evidence that an employer intended to force a resignation before they will recognize a constructive discharge. The Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit are on the other side. And I think there's a very definite reason for that, and it's reflected in these decisions. What you're talking about is a termination. It's the functional equivalent of a termination, a constructive discharge. It's the capital punishment in the employment arena. And it's very difficult for an employer to defend against a decision to terminate when it's really the employee who's made that decision and not the employer. Now, what I think you need to consider is much of the same evidence that comes before a court or an agency in a given case can be used to infer intent. Let me give you an example, and I don't think we have to go any further than looking to one of the cases the division has cited for your review, the Sites case. That was a case where the court borrowed from the Bratchett case and said, we're going to apply this standard requiring some type of evidence of employer intent in a civil rights case under Chapter 659. But what did they do? They found that there was a constructive discharge, and the only evidence of intent that they required was evidence that the supervisor had recommended that the person be discharged and that the person was moved to a different work location. There was no evidence outright that the employer intended or was on the verge of terminating that person. So what the court did is said that's sufficient evidence to infer intent. Another thing I'd like to point out is when we talk about a take it or leave it type of black and white, the employee will have no choice but to leave, I think that simplifies the issue. For instance, many of the cases that come up in this area and some of the examples given by the division involve situations where an employee perhaps felt that their pay was discriminatory, that they were denied a promotion for discriminatory purposes, that they were harassed. Each of those independent employment actions gives rise to a cause of action. If a person was denied a promotion because of their sex, that's a cause of action. If a person was harassed on the job, that's a work environment harassment cause of action. All we're talking about with this bill is whether they also have the right, without any type of proof of employer intent, to claim that the termination was also, that a resignation was also a termination cause of action. And I don't think it's asking too much, really, for an employer for an employee to have to prove some type of evidence that the employer intended that they leave the workplace. If there are dirty jokes going on in the workplace, I don't think that's anything that any of us condone. If there are innuendos and that type of thing going on in the workplace, that's one thing. But if you throw the question of whether a reasonable, prudent person would consider that so intolerable as to be forced to resign to a judge or a jury, because 659 cases, depending on the cause of action, can go either to a judge or a jury. I think it makes it very difficult for employers to predict, and that evidence of intent is a safety valve that should exist.
You're talking about the merits of the policy. I want you to back up for a moment, Ms. Peck.
Okay.
It seems to me we're talking about two different concepts here. You have the tort of wrongful discharge, which is a court action. We do recognize it in statute. And then you have some statutory remedies for civil rights, statutory remedies for unlawful employment practices. And as I understood the testimony from the Bureau of Labor and Industries folks, they were saying they're not trying to fool around with the wrongful discharge definition in terms of tort actions where people sue employers. They're only concerned that that's going to slop over into statutory actions under Chapter 659 where someone goes to Boley with a civil rights complaint or someone says this is an unlawful employment practice. And they're saying for purposes of unlawful employment practices in Boley, a different standard would apply where you don't get into figuring out what someone's state of mind is. You simply look at what they did in terms of deliberately allowing some conditions to exist, and then is the employee reasonable in saying, I've been effectively fired? Of course, under their theory, then, I suppose you might successfully have a civil rights complaint or a statutory action under unlawful employment practice. Then you try to turn around and sue in tort, where the big bucks usually are, and you find that you can't make it because you can't prove intent. That's their theory, and I'd like to ask you to respond to that. Do you have a problem with that separate theory?
Yes. Yes, and I don't think, first of all, I think it is, again, a simplification to say, the Brachet case was a tort case, an intentional tort case. That shouldn't apply here. There are different theories of discrimination. Some of those theories require proof of intent, and some don't. The type of cases that we're talking about here are generally intentional discrimination cases. They've historically been intentional discrimination cases. And I think that's part of the underlining reason why a majority of the circuits that have addressed this issue have required some type of evidence that the employer intended to force the person to resign before they will hold an employer responsible for terminating the person in violation of a sex or race or other prohibited class statute. I don't think, well, there's another point that deserves to be made. Two of the fastest growing types of statutory discrimination are workers' comp discrimination and handicap discrimination. Both of those give rise to tort damages under the Oregon statute. So what essentially you would be doing to an employer who, for instance, might be looking to try to get an employee back to work who was out on workers' comp, they may have problems, conditions may be imposed on that employee for returning to work, for taking a light duty job, for working in a capacity that perhaps that employee didn't like to work in. And what you would be doing by accepting the definition incorporated in this Senate bill is essentially saying if all of that evidence is considered and a reasonable prudent person, a jury were to decide that a reasonable prudent person under the circumstances was justified in quitting, then there need to be no evidence. The employer could sit on the stand and say, I didn't want this person to quit. We didn't want the person to quit. And that would be irrelevant to the inquiry. It wouldn't help the employer in defending the case.
Go ahead. Questions? Kathy, is the reasonable person test different than the subjective belief of the employee test?
Oh, it would be. And one thing I want to mention.
Define the differences because, and comment specifically on whether what this bill employs. Because I don't read this to be the employee's own perception.
No.
As being relevant.
Basically, what this bill does, I think, is it doesn't say that you employ individually. Perhaps you have a hypersensitive employee that decides they're going to resign to escape some type of an employment action because they felt it was based on their sex or their race or what have you. If we're dealing with sex discrimination, race discrimination, national origin, and the types of causes of action that go to a bench trial, were to decide that that person wasn't reasonable, that person would not be declared constructively discharged under this bill.
Even though they may have believed in their mind that this was the worst of the worst, unless you could get sort of the man or woman on the street. A test that person would have also agreed, the employee will lose the case.
That's true. Yeah. My concern is, and I probably wouldn't be here making as strong an argument if we didn't have particular prohibited class that gave rise to jury trial rights.
Well,
and we do.
Mr. Chair, I want to ask her a couple questions and hopefully keep her at task on these questions.
Okay.
Appreciate your concern in the jury system. And that's,
yeah, I mean, that's one of the unknowns that employers are concerned about.
Now, you said that in the Ninth Circuit, the federal law
at least it applies in the Ninth Circuit, the case law does not require the intent to discharge.
That's right, a third of the ninth.
And since we, Oregon is within the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, under federal law in Oregon, employees need not prove the intent of the employer to discharge.
They need not prove specific intent on the employer's part to force resignation.
Okay, so the federal state case here, the Bratcher, I think it's called, case, does seem to be at odds with federal law as it applies in jurisdictions covering Oregon.
Well, not actually, because the Bratcher case is just an intentional tort discrimination case.
I understand that, but in terms of consistency with civil rights law, it does seem to add an element that the federal courts in Oregon do not require.
The Seitz case would add an element that the Ninth Circuit would not require, but the majority of circuits require proof of intent.
Okay. And I'd like you to finally address, I know you were here when I asked the question about that we've been, and maybe we're overly sensitized by the severe problems of sexual abuse in our society and the really heinous stuff that's going on. And I know in my practice I have unfortunately represented women who had some very serious harassment bordering on criminal activity by employers. So I appreciate that you're having to advocate for the worst guy here, because these are bad actors out there that are really truly discriminating. And I know you don't support those people, but I should say, because we've appeared on several panels together and I've heard you speak before. But what about the employer who discriminates and without the intent of discharge, in fact, with hoping that their victim won't escape, that they would like that their victim to stay on the job place? Let's say it's sexual harassment of a female employee, and you know, the last thing in the world this guy wants is for her to leave. So it seems to me that is even a worse situation of harassment and discrimination than the employer who says, I'm going to sexually harass you, and by the way, I hope you'll quit. Because it seems to me those are kind of inconsistent with the mentality of the people we're dealing with here. Because I'm not after the occasional sort of innocent, bad taste that may be very damaging to a person in its own right. I'm talking about the really bad actors here. Shouldn't this law be broad enough to include them? Because it seems to me that if we leave in the intent of the employer to discharge, we're creating a loophole that lets the worst of the worst through.
I don't share that concern. And the reason I don't share that concern is because in actuality, if an employer goes into a courtroom or that type of a setting, and there is evidence that a woman has been harassed and examples of how that's happened, and it's generally a combination of things, a combination of the jokes and the innuendos and what I would refer to as environmental harassment and actions taken on the part of the employer. Any time an employer departs from its normal policies or procedures in the treatment of a person, or refuses to promote, or puts a person on probation, or watches them more closely, all of that infers an intent to force a resignation. It's all evidence that the employer truly intended to discriminate. And go back to the Seitz case, which is one of the cases that the division is seeking to have reversed here. That court applied a standard that required proof that the employer intended to force the person to resign, And all that was necessary for that person to prevail on a constructive discharge case is evidence that supervisors recommended the person be discharged and that the person was temporarily transferred to a different work location, and that is with an intentional discrimination requirement, with a requirement that there be proof.
Mr.
And that
Chair,
was enough to satisfy it.
Mr. Chair, in the Seitz case, the witness is entirely correct. I read now from the case that the employer requested a suspension and that the plaintiff be actually removed from position. So that they said that in view of the fact that the suspension had the effect of removing her to a different work site, they intended to terminate her, and there was entitled to an inference that there was retaliation because of that. But that isn't the situation I'm getting at. I mean, you mentioned in your opening remarks, I believe, that it would be irrelevant for an employer to get up and testify whether or not they intended to discharge. But
irrelevant was probably certainly would be relevant to the whole. It just wouldn't be an effective defense.
Clarifying that. But if we were to, under the existing case law, if the Bureau of Labor and Industries is correct that is a sort of become the template of the test in, under state law in Oregon for constructive discharge. Then, if the employer were accused of this and they testified, yes, I harassed her, yes, I made conditions intolerable, yes, she left because of the conditions I created, but I didn't want her to go, that would be relevant and could actually defeat the claim if the jury believed that that element of intent was missing, no matter how bad the harassment was or how clearly it resulted in her leaving work.
If the jury believed that, but if that
but
was
they, but they would with, be allowed to, wouldn't they?
They would, if some type of evidence of intent is required, and they believed the employer when the employer testified that I didn't want this to happen, I didn't want her to resign.
And doesn't that run counter to the whole idea that the policy of civil rights and employment is to prevent harassment on the job?
Well, see, that woman would not give up. That woman would not give up the right to bring that claim. She still maintains the absolute right to bring a claim that the way she was treated, if she was promoted, if she was subjected to sexual harassment in the work environment, that's an independent statutory claim on which she has a right to recover. We're just talking about whether damages for termination should flow when an employer didn't intend to force the person to resign.
I just, with the indulgence of the chair, I want to pursue this because I think this is very important. If the woman proves grievous, outrageous harassment, and she leaves her work as a result of it, are you saying that there is another civil rights statute that allows her to bring a claim for the loss of her job?
Okay. No, what would typically happen is that there would be independent claims. There would be a claim that she was subjected to sexual harassment, and it would give rise, and I'm sure Sue Jordan and those from the division would agree to me, it would give rise to an independent claim for work environment sexual harassment.
And what are the damages she would be allowed to recover?
Attorney fees, cease and desist order.
I don't want to pay
attorney. It's not
I'm worried
pay.
About her.
It's not back pay.
It's not back pay. No. Is it not?
And it wouldn't be reinstatement.
It would be reinstatement.
It would not be reinstatement or back pay.
She wouldn't get her job back. She wouldn't get any back wages.
Unless termination on the basis of sex was proven.
And it was intended to be a termination.
The employer intended some
kind of
termination.
Okay, so he didn't want her to leave. He liked it. He liked the victim role she was in. And I really want to hone in on those people because that's where I want to understand that person who leaves that work under exist, as you're saying, would not be allowed to recover back wages, would not be allowed to be reinstated to her job, would not be allowed any loss of employment opportunities that she had she been remained on the job.
No.
She would get her
let me say this. I think, again, it's hard to simplify these cases.
I mean,
what frequently happens is that the woman in this case, as you described the example, objects to the harassment. She may not. She may wait until after she leaves the employment.
Yeah.
It's often, you know, it can happen either way.
In the worst
All of the evidence about what went on goes into testimony. In fact, I have a couple of cases here where, in jurisdictions where there was a requirement that there be some type of evidence of intent. One case involved a woman who was pregnant and said, I really don't want to work in this department, and then the employer assigned her to that department. The court inferred evidence that the employer intended to force her to resign. What I'm trying to drive home is I think it would be a misnomer for this committee, you committee members, to assume that evidence of intent has to consist of the employer admitting or some real directive evidence that the employer intended to force the person to resign. That's not the way the case law works. If the working conditions were difficult for the employee to work under, they objected about, the court is entitled to infer intent.
Chair.
Go ahead.
You may have covered this ground just a minute ago when I stepped out for a second, but I'm curious if, in the two scenarios that Representative Edmondson is going on, the one where you got the same exact harassment, but in one case the employer wants them to quit, the other case the employer doesn't want the person to quit, in his or her mind, what are the differences in the damages? You touched early in your testimony about there already being causes of action for harassment, regardless of whether the person leaves the employment or not.
Okay.
What's the difference in damages?
Right now, given the case law we have in Oregon, right now the difference in damages is if there was an evidence that the employer intended to force the person to resign, the person would be entitled to back wages, to either reinstatement or something they call front pay, which is in lieu of reinstatement. and attorney fees and an injunction ordering the employer to cease and desist from the unlawful activities. If the employer committed a violation, but it didn't consist of forcing the person to resign, then what you would do is drop the back wages and the reinstatement of front pay, and the person would be entitled to recover attorney fees and have a cease and desist order. And if they'd been discriminatorily demoted or denied pay because of their sex, of course there'd be back wages flowing from that in the amount of the differential of the wages. So
let's not get confused with those.
I mean, essentially, it's back wages and reinstatement you're talking about.
Either way?
Back wages and reinstatement would not flow absent employer evidence of intent to force a resignation under existing case law in Oregon.
Okay. Any other questions, Kathy?
No.
Kathy, we really appreciate you coming down, even more so than Carl. Carl, we appreciate you.
Good to see you again.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Joe Benninghoff to join. Back in the corner, okay. Joe, welcome to the Labor Committee.
Percentage participation.
No, we do not.
And we don't have that for the foster parents.
No, we do not.
In terms of the suggestion of doing this for blind persons who participate in this program, is it because of the size of the group or the nature of the group that you're talking about this as a possible requirement?
It really had nothing to do with either one. It was simply because we were concerned against adding a self-pay group at all. They were willing to look at this to try and deal with our concerns. They were willing to require that a minimum level of employees enroll in it, which then does, it doesn't remove the self-pay issue that we're concerned about in full, but it does address the issue of, like Mike stated, that it gives you a better cross-section that helps pool the group and come out with better
what
experience.
What I'm getting at is Representative Dominey's concern, and I suppose my reaction is, if the reason, the concept of this program is kind of unique in the sense we're saying to a bunch of people, hey boy, you can join in if you want to, but you don't have to, which is unlike, well, employees may sign up or not, but they're not going to get cash back or they're not going to have to participate. The idea I'm getting at here is, if the only reason you want to make a differentiation is that it's A, small group, and B, it's self-pay voluntary participation, and that the reason for wanting a minimum number or percentage is not because they're blind, they could be trapeze artists, they could be any kind of category of people, but you're concerned about the size of the group and the self-pay concept, that you're worried that people who will tend to buy the program will be people who have greater medical needs, regardless of their blind status. Is that what?
Representative Mannix, that's right. The size of the group, again, that's not the issue really either. It's the self-pay is really the only issue.
Because people who
Because they can pick and choose. Those that need it will take it. Those that don't need it won't take it.
I see. Of course, a lot of people make the mistake of thinking they don't need it, then they have a car accident tomorrow. But that's another story.
Yes, my only concern is here comes the camel. And we've never had a means test before to get in, and now if we come, there'll be later other groups that will be trying to put some kind of a means test out there of some assortment. So I guess, not that I oppose that concept, that's what it takes to get the legislation passed, but I still say here comes the camel. And so we just need to keep that in mind.
Well, I just... recall that we are prohibited from granting a privilege to any group of citizens that's not extended on the same basis to all other similarly situated citizens. That's the Oregon Equal Privileges Clause of the Constitution. So we couldn't have access for blind people on different terms, I believe, than we allow access for all other similarly situated state vendors or groups. So if we're going to deal with the proposal that there be a minimum 70% or 50% or whatever percent, that had better be come back as an amendment to access to the program generally for all similarly situated groups. And the question I have then is, if the proposal, as I understand it, is not necessarily a means test as much as a group rate test, that there be enough people in that group joined before anyone is allowed to take advantage of this. What's your response to that? Would that satisfy your concern?
It doesn't remove our concerns by any means. I think it addresses it much better, yes, because, again, we're broadening the group and getting a cross-section that helps us deal with that.
So we might actually do something to improve the situation that you've been objecting to all these years if we were to impose such a standard.
That's right.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman? Go ahead. As a follow-up on all of this, it seems to me that just about any kind of health insurance plan has some minimum participation requirements. I'm surprised the state doesn't, or maybe there aren't other firms like this. My own firm, I can't maintain the program unless a certain percentage of employees participate, and the insurers say that because they figure that if you've set it up in such a way that only a limited number of people are buying in, they're the ones who want the medical services because they need them. And the whole point is you float these plans by having people who don't need them help pay for them. That's what insurance is all about. Have you thought about where you would put this amendment, how you would change the law to require some minimum percentage of participation?
Representative Mannix, no. Other than our current eligibility rules or our current statutes do define what an eligible employee is. The groups that have come to us on a self-pay basis do not meet that definition and have come to the legislature and been given an exception to be treated as an employee for insurance purposes only. That's how it's gotten in. So as far as us responding to how we would deal with an amendment, no, I haven't.
Just a follow-up on that, then I concur with Representative Edmondson that this minimum participation standard ought to apply to all these let's buy in and self-pay groups. In fact, I'd like to see it in there as a protective device anyway, because then other people will have to compare themselves to that standard. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, maybe as they undertake this investigation of the other groups, what we might want to do is assess the history of the participation level of those groups to make sure that we aren't going to be carving somebody out of here or at least consider that before we take action on that amendment. I'd hate to think that the foster care owners are only participating in 20% and we set a 50% threshold and we just caused demise of their program.
I'd also like another question. Perhaps could you bring us some information showing that the costs are greater for these individuals? That would help us to really understand the problem.
Mr. Chairman, one other item. If we do amend that bill, I would also like to add the language that's up above, which talks about the blind business enterprises or people in private non-profits set up, to add that language about those people down below for the retirement purposes. For some reason, they're left out, so I'd like to address that as well.
Thank you very much.
Find the people the same in both paragraphs.
Okay, we're going to take a break because some of the fellows have to go for it.
Lost their quorum.
Yeah, we lost their quorum. So we have to go to a hearing, so we're going to
stop for a little bit.
Bill 2611.
We did not move, Mr. Chairman, 2099 for those conditions of amendments, possibly. Is that what's going to take place?
We're going to hear back.
Yeah, thank you.
Chair, you're welcome to the Labor Committee. Do I have an audience?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members?
Mr. Chairman, can we point out that Representative Barnes, he didn't pack him in.
Somebody got a camera.
I think they got siphoned off to another meeting. They were a whole mess amount.
Mr. Chair, what it reminds me of is a C-SPAN. When the camera goes out there once in a while, it spans what's happening in Congress. Well, you can feel just as important as a congressman now.
Well, I have Barnes. Mr. Cruz back here. But
why don't you come up and see? He doesn't want to be here all by himself.
I can tell you that if the only thing worse than having an empty room is having a room full of opponents. So this may be a blessing in disguise.
Representative Barnes, would you like me to introduce your bill, or would you like to do that yourself?
I'll do that if you like. For the record, my name is Jerry Barnes, State Representative, District 52. Mr. Chair and members, I introduce House Bill 2611 for a number of reasons. And, of course, I guess I should say up front that I am a veteran of several times over, I suppose. I served in the Korean War and 8 campaigns in Vietnam, and I retired in 1975 as a Navy officer after 25 years. So I speak with a little bit of a background, but certainly I'm no expert in some of these things.
I guess it's always bothered me, and I know it's bothered an awful lot of veterans, as to why a person who chose to make a career out of the military is in fact discriminated against by saying, yes, you're a veteran in one respect, but another you're not. And I'm speaking to the preference in getting a state job. It seems to me like that there's a, I think, a goodly degree of justice being performed here. And don't get me wrong, I'm not one that I wouldn't want to work for the state government. Being a legislator, I can fully understand that more now. But it seems to me like we're saying to people who choose to make a career out of the military that, well, the fact that you've done that means that for some reason you don't quite measure up as being a veteran in the eyes of the citizens of Oregon. And I think what we're saying is that those veterans who served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, now Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, and the Gulf are somewhat less of a patriotic citizen, I suppose, than those who went in and in some cases never left the United States but served 180 some days as being a veteran. It just seems to me like there's a disconnect there. A little bit of a background. You know, the Congress permits people, there's different categories of retirees, I must add. By and large, an enlisted person who retires can retire at 19 years, 6 months, and 1 day. Now, what that means is through the constructive service time, they're given credit for 20 years. So they draw a retainer pay. They are not retired. They don't become retired until they active and in a sense inactive, comes to 30 years. So they draw a retainer pay. Officers actually retire. But you're still subject to two laws. You're still amenable to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I am, and this gentleman here, he's a retired Air Force Master Sergeant. You're still amenable to that. You're still subject to call at any time if they need you. And I know a lot of people have been recalled for the Gulf. So, and I guess in a sense, Oregon says, well, if you choose to make a career out of it and become a leader, and we're not going to give you the same benefits in terms of veterans' preference and whatever that people who would have if they did not choose to make a career. I think perhaps, and I don't know how big of a deal this is, but perhaps the fact that Oregon has a setup to where you're not a veteran if you draw retainer or retired pay, that may be counterproductive to what the Congress of the United States wants to do. I know at different times in my career I've been what they call career retention officers, which means I try to convince people to re-enlist, make a career. And of course Congress has all kinds of bonuses to get them to do that. But it may be counterproductive. Congress does that for a purpose. Number one, they need leaders. You can't have people come in and leave without having somebody with some continuity being leaders. So it's difficult, and you know, I would submit to you that let's take an Army sergeant who's a tank commander in the Gulf. When he comes back and retires, he may have been shot at or may have been not, but he was there. The state of Oregon is going to say, well, okay, we're not going to count you as being a veteran. Something seems to be wrong with that concept. And I don't try to second guess what past legislatures have done, and I don't know what the pros and cons were, but it just seems to me like that there was a misconception of basically what a person is like once they retire. As you know, you can go in at 17 and you can retire at about 38 years of age. At 38 years of age, you've got some young children. You've got kids in school, and certainly in some cases, they're not even ready to go to college yet. You don't make enough money to subsist. You know, if you've got a young family, you must go to work. There's just no doubt about that. So not everybody would want to go to work for the state government or local government, but it just seems to me like that they should have that option there. So I guess the point I want to make is that it seems to me like when you cut off the fact that a person has served 19 years and 6 months or 30 years or 35, whatever, you're saying, well, you were patriotic, but you weren't patriotic enough to where we're going to recognize and give you the veteran's preference when it comes to working for state government.
So I think that's the basic thrust of it. So with that, I'd like to say I appreciate your support on this, if you would. I think it's long time coming, and I think a lot of veterans who have retired or draw what we call retainer pay would appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Labor Committee, for the record, I am Master Sergeant Walter Cruz, United States Air Force retired, and the Oregon State Deputy Legislative Affairs Representative for the Noncommissioned Officers Association, NCOA. I wish to thank this committee for its efforts on House Bill 2611 and also Representative Barnes. The NCOA wishes to go on record as in favor of this bill. While the following information is several years old, it is still valid for today's military retiree. Average age is 48. Average rank or grade is E6. The average number of dependents is 1.2. Please note, this information was furnished by the National Headquarters of the Noncommissioned Officers Association and is the latest available, which was about 2 years ago. I might add my own personal statistics. When I retired in 1969, I was 40 years old and E7. I had a wife and five kids. My retirement pay was about under $250 a month. This means the average retiree is an enlisted person, married and with children either in high school or college. With 20 to 30 years of active duty in the armed forces, they are wanting to settle down and start on a new career. Many have been supervisors or have other years of experience that can be invaluable to an employer. Yet the state of Oregon currently does not even recognize the armed forces retiree as a veteran when it comes to employment. The retiree is not given preference points for state employment, while a veteran of only 3 or 4 years of service is given the points. Are these points used to make it easier for the veteran to get a state job and help readjust to civilian life? And who is in more need? The young, one-term service person or the retiree that has given 20 years or more years in the service of their country? Or are the preference points given as a reward for service to their country? Again, then who would be the more deserving? The one-term service person or the retiree that has served 5 or more terms? Passage of House Bill 2611 would remove this unfair discrimination against a group of veterans whose only fault was that they served their country too long, according to the state of Oregon. The NCOA is solidly behind this recommended change to ORS 408.225, as depicted in House Bill 2611. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. And I'm open to questions.
Yes.
Sergeant Cruz, in regard to this, I can understand from the testimony of Representative Barnes also, why are we making this artificial discrimination? I cannot understand why either. I'm guessing that at some point in the federal service there's a concern about double dipping, and can someone retire from federal service and then come back into another type of position? But this has to do with a preference on civil service exam rather than as to how much retirement you ought to be getting. So I don't know why it's in here. So I understand your testimony and Representative Barnes's testimony. Let me move you away from that for a moment and assume that this kind of discrimination doesn't seem to be appropriate. Long term, and this is a philosophical question, should we at some point, however, eliminate the veterans' preference on civil service exams? And what I'm getting at is not for the veterans in the past, but now when we talk about the modern military, where everyone is a high school graduate, everybody has so much training and skills, it seems to me the veterans' preference first came in at a time when you had a lot of fellows who maybe had a ninth grade education and got in, and they served in World War II, and then they were running into discrimination when they came out, and they hadn't had a chance to get their education and so on and so forth. Should we have a phase out? And maybe that's not fair to ask you, and if it's too fresh a question, should we say that in the year, I notice we have a phase out for the year 2099 for anybody who served in Vietnam or Cambodia or Laos. We've just said that after the year 2099, we're going to do away with the veterans' preference. Should we phase it out, or is this something that, again, I'm hitting you with too fresh?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I don't think that would be a big problem as it is in terms of the discrimination. I might add, and having been in the service and through the Korean War and a few other brush fires, Oregon has a very good program in terms of the ODVA, the housing program. But overall, I've got the sense of feeling that Oregon has not been as good to its veterans, otherwise citizens who served in wars, brush fires. We call them police conflicts. We don't call them wars these days. They have not treated their veterans as well as a goodly number of other states. I can remember right after the Korean War, the federal government come out with the mustering out payment. Wasn't much, but it's a token of appreciation. I think Oregon was one of just a handful of states that did not do that. I don't know the rationale, but I think in my own mind, the rhubarb is that you have two sets of veterans, one recognized by the federal government for their lengthy service, and the other one recognized by the state of Oregon. So I can't speak for any organization, but speaking for myself, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I think. So I would have no problem with eliminating it, but I really think that it deserves some sort of a
redress. Well, you understood I was talking about in the future at some point, recognizing, trying to figure out when today's modern army, as they say sometimes, modern military types may be retiring or leaving service. I'm not talking about in the immediate future. I guess I was more getting at what was the original reason for the preference, but I agree with you that if we're going to have a preference, we should not be discriminating. I think your point's well made. I have to step out. I apologize.
Thank you. Mr.
Chairman? Yeah, what's the status?
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Jonathan, I ask in respect for Mr. Representative Mannix is departing from us. If intent is the chair is to move the bill, maybe it would be more of an incumbent for us to take that action so Mr. Okay. Mannix is not thank absent you. At the time.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
No, unless there's other burning would questions like that have to be asked.
We're going to go to the head of work session. You want to move the bill,
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 2611 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay. Any discussion? I don't want to make a comment just for a second. I sort of agree with Kevin. I served in the military, and I served 20 years in reserve. I don't personally feel like that they owe me anything. And in fact, I would rather not have a benefit of a advantage on a test. This is my personal feeling. I think it's something we should perhaps look at down the road.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. You know, my point is, let's don't discriminate what we have.
I agree with it. If we give it to one, we should give it to the other. Okay. I'm going to call the roll, please.
Representative Dominick?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson? Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Repine?
Aye.
Representative Watt?
Aye. I'm going to ask the question.
Representative
Dierfler?
Aye. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chairman, I would request that Representative Barnes have the pleasure of carrying this bill to the floor.
Thank you, sir. I was going to suggest that.
My pleasure.
And he does have a
I
question.
I have a question, and I wanted to represent Max to vote. I'm not a veteran. My brother's a career naval officer, and my little brother, and he's going to retire a long time before I do. But is the federal law on federal civil service, does it have this restriction in it? Because I understood that it's a state law that says that excludes retired off personnel.
Yes, it's a state law.
But the federal law does not make this distinction. So this becomes consistent with the national policy. Is that right? Okay, I just wanted to, I thought that was the case and didn't affect how I was going to vote. And I'd say I probably favor veterans' benefits to be maintained on the books, but I just wanted that on the record. Thank you.
You're right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you. We're going to adjourn. Representative.